kind of accidentally got left off your notes. Not that it has anything important, but I'll bring it next week. Everything in this Book of Romans is on the final exam, and it's oral. The final exam's oral, and the date is unknown, and it's pass/fail, which is good. We have a website. Peter and Rob, our lexicographers, have created a website, and if you want the address, I'll give it to you today, and I'll put it in writing next week. This is where you can go sign on and discuss and put in your understanding of these code words, these Christianese words that are all through Romans and elsewhere that nobody understands, that everybody uses all the time. We run onto a lot of these words in Romans, and we want to be able to explain them in modern English. The book of Romans, if you remember, is written by the Apostle Paul about A.D. 58. That'd be about 25 years after the resurrection, and it's written to the Christians in Rome. Apostles have the job of laying the foundations of churches, of establishing the sound doctrinal base for a local church. And as far as we know, the church in Rome had started by Christians traveling around the Roman Empire and spreading the news of the resurrection of Jesus. And so these were probably little house churches. I don't have any idea how many Christians there would be in Rome by this time, maybe hundreds or thousands in meeting in small home churches. And Paul writes this very detailed statement of the content of the message to this church at Rome, and hopes to visit there. And as far as we know, he did get to visit there about 3 years after he wrote this letter. Spent 2 years there, and probably was released from prison then, and went off and traveled, and came back and was martyred. So as far as we know, there weren't any of the apostles that had gone to Rome to start this church. Peter probably wasn't there until he died, and Paul wasn't there initially when the church started. So this is a very unique and unusual letter. We got down in last week into the first it's $1 million bills. If anybody needs $1 million, I have some stuck in my Bible here. Just come and see me afterwards and put it in your ATM and see if it bounces. Romans 1. We got down through verses 16 and 17. Verses 16 and 17 are the key pivotal introduction to the whole book. The theme of the whole book is established for us, and right away we start getting into to these big words that we need to understand. Verse 16, "For I am not ashamed," Paul says, "of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also the Greek." So there's that word gospel. If a non-Christian friend came up to you and said, "I've heard you Christians talk about the gospel, and you're always talking about preaching the gospel. Would you please tell me what is the gospel?" Would you be able to give a clear, simple, understandable idea of what the gospel is? Well, your little green sheet, most of them are green. What is the gospel? Are just a few little notes. One of the ways you find out what a word in the Bible, what it means, is to look at all the times it's used. The word gospel appears 93 times in the New Testament. So if you're ambitious, you could look at all the appearances of this word. And of course, as we mentioned last week, the gospel really is from the ancient, the old English word, Godspiel, good spiel, good news. Older term, glad tidings. That's also what the Greek original means. It means good news, good message of goodness or message of wellness, good news. Whatever the gospel is, it's an announcement of good news for all of mankind. And then I gave you several quotes in here to study so you can see what the basic essentials in the gospel message are. What is this message that you announce to people that carries with it the power of God to change their lives, to bring about salvation? Salvation is another one of those hard words. We talked about salvation means rescuing from danger, getting out from under a jail sentence. It means health and well-being and wholeness, all those things. This message, which God has ordained that should be announced, is a message that carries with it power, and it's a specific message. The opening chapter of Galatians, Paul has very strong language for those who would bring you a different gospel, who would modify this message. He says, let them be damned or cursed. So you can't change the content of the message, which people do all the time. And it's important to know what it is and what it isn't. And I gave you a few key verses that are sort of my favorite. So by next week or soon, when your non-Christian friends come up and say, what is the gospel, you can say succinctly, this is what it's all about. It's good news. Remember, it's basically an announcement of good news for the human race. And it carries with it God's power. And it's to the Jew first and the Greek. That is, it's very universal to all classes of men everywhere. In the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith, quote from Habakkuk. Now we have that word righteousness, and that we need probably, that's a lexicon entry. What is righteousness? Because we don't hardly use that term very much anymore. If you look, it's interesting in the Bible, and we'll see a little later on in Romans, that there's only one righteous man in all of history, and that's Jesus himself. None of us are righteous inherently, no matter how much we think we're righteous or would like to be righteous. Jesus is the standard of righteousness. And that we want to get into that a lot later on. And this gospel message, which is about Jesus, explains who he is and how he lived and what he did and why his humanity and his life is God's standard of how humanity is supposed to live. We'll see that. And I mentioned also, we mentioned that this little phrase from Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith, is used here and in Galatians and in Hebrews, each time with a slightly different emphasis. Here, Martin Luther discovered, the meaning is a person becomes righteous by putting his faith in Jesus. The word faith is another word we don't understand very well. Faith is a strong word. It means to receive some knowledge about something, to believe it in your heart, and to act upon it and respond upon it. And this faith has content. We all have some kind of faith. The sun will come up, and faith the chairs will hold you up. But faith in the New Testament sense is leaning your whole weight on Jesus. It's putting your whole trust in Jesus. And if you do that, and we get more in Romans into this, if you put your faith in Jesus and accept the gift of his love and grace, then he credits you with the righteousness of Jesus. He charges it to your account. We've got to get into that later on in Romans. He takes all of your sins and credits them to the account of Jesus, like a transaction. It's a very strange thing. Imputation, that's another one of those hard words. To have the righteousness of Jesus imputed to your account and have all your sins imputed to Christ's account. Transaction. That's what happens when you believe. And it's something supernatural, something that God does, apart from any merit or any works or any effort on your part. That's what happens when you believe. That's what the gospel is all about. Two-sided, yeah.
I have a little note here. It's not dated, so I put it down. But it says, the just shall live by faith. So you can also say it the other way, by faith shall live.
Well, that's what we mentioned, that in Galatians, those who are righteous shall live. Those who are righteous by faith shall live is the emphasis in Galatians. The person...
You enter that.
Yes, but if you're going, but you keep on. In Hebrews, the meaning is that you continue living by faith, that the righteous man lives by his faith, as Abraham did. So this is and also we have this little phrase, from faith to faith, from one step of faith to another, an ongoing process. So salvation isn't just a one-time trusting in Jesus. It's a whole lifestyle of continuing to trust in Jesus. Now, with that introduction in verses 16 and 17, Paul temporarily leaves the content of the gospel. He leaves that until we get down to verse 21 in chapter 3. So we get this little discussion of what's wrong with the human race, if anything. Why would anybody need this kind of good news, this message? And we have now here this very complete and thorough analysis of the human condition. And it's hard and heavy hitting. And today we want to look at the rest of chapter 1. This is difficult. You can read through Romans in about an hour if you read slowly. My good friend Ken Ammon, when he played basketball at Stanford, memorized Romans, and you could get him to come to your class and he'd recite it from memory, and then he went on and did Hebrews. So if I ever get thrown in jail without a Bible, I want my friend Ken with me so he can recite these books from memory, because it's really rather commendable to have these books in your memory. You can stop and meditate at them. This stuff in here is worth thinking about, praying about, reading over and over and over again, and it's particularly good with our lexicographers helping us to put this in your own words so that you really understand what this is all about, because it's dense, packed, tight. It begins, verse 18 begins, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Look at all those words that are really archaic. They're not. We don't use them in ordinary life very much. And we run right on to this term, wrath. Kind of dark, ugly word there appears. Now, in the Old Testament, there are about 20 different words that refer to God's anger. And maybe about 600 passages, 20 different Hebrew words that all have to do with shades of anger that God has against sin or against individuals. So this complicated subject. In the New Testament, we have two Greek words for anger. We have the word thumos, which means sudden flare-ups of anger. Road rage would be example, or that sudden flash of temper that caught you by surprise and everybody else, that flared up and went away. We all get that. You get frustrated or pushed out of shape or something goes badly wrong, and suddenly there's anger flaring up in your heart and it goes away quickly, and then you regret it. The other Greek word, orge, is the one that's used here, wrath. Orge is abiding anger. It's righteous indignation. It's moral outrage at evil. It's settled. It's something that's settled. You've made up your mind to be angry at something, and it doesn't go away. And this is God's holy anger, and the verb is in it's continuous present tense. The wrath of God is continually being revealed. We have to kind of understand this. The wrath of God is continually being released or revealed from heaven, from the spiritual realm, against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth or repress the truth in unrighteousness. You got the word unrighteous. Well, that's obviously the opposite of righteous. We have to decide what in the world is this invisible, unseen wrath of God that's supposed to be everywhere? How does that show up? Anybody have any idea how this works in daily life? This isn't exactly justice. It's not exactly God's punishing sin. It's the human condition. How does this show up in life? If God's perpetually angry in a settled way against all human ungodliness, how does that show up? Civilizations rise and fall. Yep. Great civilizations collapse and come to ruin. How about your life? Have you ever experienced anything in life that might hint at this? Checking account. Yeah, your bank balance, you never have quite enough money. Tragedies, disasters, the sort of bittersweet side of life. You get your dream home and then you don't like it and can't afford it. And job goes away and somebody close to you dies. And there's this melancholy side of life that you're never quite fulfilled. There's always this sorrow and sadness that goes along with the very best things in life. Now, this wrath of God is directed against ungodliness. The closing verse of John 3, he who has the Son of God has life, but he who does not have the Son of God does not have life, but the wrath of God rests on him. So it's this wrath of God which rests on unbelievers isn't resting on you, especially. Although Psalm 90 talks about all of us are under God's wrath all our lives long. That is, that life never is fully fulfilling and satisfying, even for God's people. But this wrath is directed against unbelievers.
Could be, or would you consider this phrase, the wrath of God, to be a displeasure
we aren't unhappy all the time, but there are certain areas in our personality that reach our displeasure. And you're very unhappy in a person or an incomplete
that's part of your personality. Excellent.
And so God, he's not unhappy, but there is an area that's his displeasure, and we can go farther and farther and farther into it, and he becomes more displeased.
Right. The displeasure is excellent. And it's a hostility against evil and against sin that reflects his divine displeasure. Now, we also have in the New Testament, we have the idea that God's wrath is stored up, that God's anger is stored up for Judgment Day. And on Judgment Day, God will open all the books and get out all the records against everybody, and that nothing will be spared. And his anger and his wrath, both Greek words, will be released against the whole of mankind. We also have periodic judgments that go on in life where God does something, pulls the rug out from under people, or collapses a nation. Those are in addition to this abiding displeasure. Well, I think if you think about it in your life, what are the things that you detest, that you hate, that you loathe, that are for good reasons? That's a little bit like what God is. He's a holy, loving God. He hates things that are destructive, harmful, injurious. Okay, and what is this? It's directed against ungodliness. Now, ungodliness doesn't mean so much not believing in God. It means ignoring God. How about people ignoring God in our world, not paying any attention to Him? Oh, yes, I believe in God, and then going on as if God didn't exist. Well, that's what ungodliness is all about. And unrighteousness, if you don't have the righteousness of Christ, then you are unrighteous, and you're living on your unrighteousness, and God's hostile to that because it's not the way He created the universe. Here He made this whole universe for His own good pleasure, and He invites you to come live here for a while and be His house guest. What kind of a house guest are you in His home? Now, there's something real interesting going on here. It says that men habitually suppress the truth, hold down the truth in unrighteousness, deny the truth, pretend that God isn't there, ignore God, isn't that the way the world runs? How much do you turn on the television, how much do you find God getting credit for good things that happen? You won't find that on any nature programs, because Mother Nature does all the things that are positive and creative. How many times do you tune on and see something that's accomplished and say God's justice was served today, or may God be praised for the wonderful things He's doing? That it's a no-no to talk about God in public life in this country. Well, that's actually very disgraceful. Take laws out of the courthouse, remove the presence of God, any reminder of God. This says that people actually hate God. Why do people hate God? Why would you hate a loving God? Well, you hate him because he's sovereign, for one thing. He wants to run the universe according, and he doesn't do what you tell him to do. And since the fall, man has wanted to be his own God, and we all want to run our own lives, and that's the whole human race is a whole bunch of anarchists down here. Everybody wanting to run his own life, and that's in opposition to the real God, who is the sovereign. We even have that encounter that in government. You know, we like democracy because it's supposed to give us maximum freedom to do what we want with as few restrictions as possible. But God's government's a monarchy where we're subject to the king. We don't like God because he's immutable. He doesn't ever change. He's uncompromising. He won't budge on his standards. He knows everything about us. He sees right through us, so you can't fool him. And I'm a master of deceit. I deceive myself. I deceive others. I manipulate. I waffle around on important issues, and God looks right through to my heart with his X-ray vision, and I can't hide. No place to hide. I don't like that very well. And he's just, and he's fair. I don't like that. I don't like him being just. He could be just with you, but I hope he isn't just with me. Now, if you start to think about this, why should people hate God? Now, if you can't change God from who He is, but you still want God, then you can have a religion. You can build a new model of God. You can make your own model of God and tone down who he really is and change things about him. And pretty soon you build a religious system in which you're serving your own idea of God, but it's not the real God. And that's a terrible insult to the real God. Now, that's see what Paul's beginning to get at. Yeah. Yep. How can you do this? How could you let this? And bad things happen to all of us, and God doesn't explain himself. Why somebody young and important dies, or why there's a terrible accident, or why we get cancer. He doesn't stop and explain himself. Yeah, we do. And that's because we wish we had all knowledge, and we don't. And we are reluctant to trust him. That's true. Yeah, that's exactly right. Bill? We really know. Now we get it. Let's go. Let's move in here. Move on to verse 19. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven because that which may be known about God is manifest in them. God has shown it to them. Now, this is one of the most important secrets of the whole Christian faith. Everybody knows that there's a God. Even the atheists know that there's a God. The word atheist, the word theos, God, it has a without God. That's an atheist isn't somebody who believes there is no God. It's somebody who doesn't want God in their life. An agnostic, that's without knowledge of God. Everybody knows that there's a God. This is a wonderful thing when you're talking to non-Christians. Deep down under all those layers of suppressed truth, in the heart of hearts, all people know that there's a God. And the Bible here says God has shown them evidence of himself. Now, this is what we call in the Bible, it's called general revelation or natural revelation. This is the knowledge of God that's available by observation. Observation of nature, of the universe, observation of our own hearts and consciences. What about the evidence for God in nature? How does that show up? Now, you don't get everything about God revealed in nature or in your conscience. You don't know everything about God. But you know enough about God to be without any excuse. What do we know from nature?
The universe is big.
It's really big. It's amazingly intricate. Shows all kinds of evidence of design, of intricacy, of complexity, of order. It's rational enough, and everything's rational enough that you can understand it and marvel at it. Do we have times in our lives when we marvel at nature? We certainly do. You sunset on the beach and looking at flowers and looking at things under the microscope and looking through telescopes. Do you see, are you caught with any kind of sense of wonder and awe at the creation? Yes, indeed. We're supposed to be that way. Children have it, of course. You have to start talking yourself out of that. Now, what about just from your own inner life? What has happened when you told the first lie that you ever told? When your parents said something? Do you ever catch a little kid lying? Do they know that they've told a lie? Yes, they do. Go out to a culture in the middle of a pagan culture out in the middle of the jungle. Do they have a basic kind of morals, whether they observe them or not? Do they have a moral standard? Yep. Do they value family life? Yes, generally. Do they generally disapprove of murder, usually? Of lying, stealing, cheating? Yes. Do you have a conscience, even if it's gotten a little hardened, that gives you a kind of sense of right and wrong? Did you come into this world with an awareness of God? Yes, you did. Do little children have that? Yes, indeed they do. How do you lose that? You lose that by starting to deny God at a very early age and working very, very hard at it. Ray Stedman used to talk about the fact that you have to get a PhD to be a good atheist. He says it worked very, very, very hard at suppressing the obvious knowledge about God. You have to work at it your whole life long and convince yourself over and over again in the face of all the overwhelming evidence that God's there. His eternal power and deity are evident in creation. So this is helpful when we're talking to non-Christians. because they think there is no God, or they have talked themselves out of believing in God, but we know that they know, and we can operate on it. We don't have to prove the existence of God. It's evident when you peel off enough layers of repression. So there's the process of repression or suppression or twisting the truth. If you can't deny God altogether, then you just make God into what you'd like him to be like and believe in that sort of a God. All kinds of churches do that. Okay, the wrath of God. God's anger is directed against all human beings who persist in their denial of God, suppressing and hiding all the knowledge of God that they have that's available to them, that God has already made known to the human race. And ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Clearly, his invisible attributes, his power, his mind, his intelligence, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Without excuse everywhere. No matter where you live, no matter what you've been told, no one has any excuse. So now that somebody says to you, well, what about the people out in the jungle that have never heard about Jesus? What do you say to them? Do they have enough light to follow that if they followed it, they could eventually find God? Yes. We'll see that in the next chapter. That yes, they do. How about us? How about us? Not only do we have this inborn knowledge of God from nature, but we've been given all this additional information. Are we without any excuse? The gospel's been broadcast in this country so that the message has been made clear not only in nature, but by all the additional preaching of this message. Well, we're much, much more without any excuse whatsoever. Now, what happens? What is the result? How do people behave? Verse 21, because although they knew God, knew who God was, had evidence of God, undeniable evidence of who God was, they did not glorify him. We need a synonym for glorify. Honor. Show. Do. Glorified. Did not glorify him, nor were thankful. There's two things here. There's the glorify has and did not glorify and did not give thanks. Honor, the word glory, he's got the word honor in it, revere, respect, give credit to, obedience, acknowledge. Now, we're starting here in the position that if we were all in a right relationship with God, our hearts would be preoccupied with worship. That's the number one central activity in heaven. It's the normal Christian life is a life of worship, which means all day long thanking God, talking to him, being grateful for things that are happening, maintaining an open communication with him all day long, 7 days a week, 24/7. That's what worship is. The first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, would mean to live in a one-on-one, one-to-one relationship with your Creator to all day long, to bring him into your thoughts, your activities, the ordinary things you're doing, practice of the presence of God, Brother Lawrence, and so on like that. That's the normal thing. I was sort of jolted last summer when a friend of mine said he had to go to worship rehearsal. And I thought, what in the world is that? That's certainly no such thing as worship rehearsal. But I think a lot of people grow up and think that worship is something you do for 20 minutes on Sunday morning. You go in and sing the music that you don't like, and that's you paid your duty to God, and then you get all psyched up. And if it's a good Pentecostal church, you'll get emotionally uplifted a little bit. Then you're off the hook for the rest of the week. Well, that's really far, far from this biblical idea of worship. All day long. Now, this is a real test for all of us. How easy it is to be distracted. How easy it is to lose that close fellowship of gratitude, of appreciation, of wonder, of reverence, of respect for God, fear of God in the healthy sense. Now, you see, that's where we ought to be. See, that's Paul's argument. Because, though they knew God, knew who he was, had evidence of him, they did not honor him, and we're not thankful, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Two things happen. Lose track of God, push him out of the center of your life, automatically consequences follow in two areas. One of them in the mind and the other one in the heart. This is, gets very scary in a quick hurry. When you forget about God, there are inevitable things that follow, and they and a whole cascade. This whole chapter is all about this, this downhill spiral that human beings get into, that societies get into, that groups of people get into. Futile in their thinking. Futile, what is futile thinking? Rationalizing of philosophies, lifestyles, useless. Yeah, doesn't lead you anywhere productive. Empty. Yeah, futile. How about having your foolish hearts darken? The fool is the Greek word. The Greek root word is moros. M-O-R-O-S for moron. But it doesn't just mean immoral. It means people that make dumb, stupid mistakes. Foolish. Wasted your life. Wasted your money. Missed out on all the important things. That's the idea between foolish. Now, foolish hearts were darkened. That's pretty scary. What does that mean? It means you lose your moral compass. It means that your emotions get clouded and distorted, and you begin to put your affections in the wrong place, and the motivation in your heart transfers away from God to something other than God. This is all it centers around the first commandment of loving the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and might. And the moment you stop doing that, then a bunch of things are inevitable. Professing to be wise, they became fools. That's really the kind of a joke. And if you think about the academic, intellectual world, the people that write books, the professors that give great lectures, the politicians that stand up, all the experts that we have in this world are making all these great speeches. And as far as God is concerned, it's all foolishness. The 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 is some of my favorite parts of the Bible. The wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. It pleased God through the foolishness of what we preach to save those who believe. The human race just loves to be pompous and arrogant and proud, and to have all these fancy-sounding philosophies to live by, and they're all futile, foolish and empty. It's kind of a big cosmic joke, isn't it? People, and then verse 23, human beings change or exchange the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made with, one, corruptible man, two, birds, three, four-footed beasts, and creeping things. If you're not going to have Jesus at the center of your life, if you're not going to serve Him and worship Him, we are made to be always worshiping something. It's a very subtle process by which you stop worshiping and serving and honoring God and begin to get a substitute in your life. And there's a deteriorating order here that easily, probably the easiest idol in your life would be another person. Boyfriend, girlfriend, somebody that you idealize, that becomes a tangible human being that takes the place of Jesus in the center of your affections in your heart. We can't see God. We all like to have something a little more tangible. The easiest kind of idolatry is to idolize another person. Falling in love, that's all about, that's what all the romantic things is all about. But you notice this downhill style. If you ever get off into idolatry, you're likely to go from the higher to the lower. It runs to birds, four-footed beasts, and creeping things. The Egyptians, of course, were the most polytheistic people who ever lived. They had gods for beetles and snakes and crocodiles and bulls, and everything that moved over in Egypt was turned into a god and mummified cats and mummified ibises. And here's this religion that's gone all the way downhill to making gods out of everything that moves and lives. Sacred cows in India. So this isn't just idolatry of stone statues. It's kind of worshiping the forces that you imagine are in nature. Fate and chance and luck. And we're awfully clever about our idolatry in this culture, are we not? Money, power. But it's all the same thing. What do you love? What do you love in your heart? Where are your affections? What are you motivated? What motivates you? What drives you? Look at Paul's analysis of the human condition starting with the fact that we all ought to be loving God with our whole hearts and minds and souls. And that's difficult. And we ought to be doing it all the time.
Just yesterday I was watching a documentary
about
what happened in Hawaii.
And
they had one lady that was talking about the ancient religion in Hawaii. And she was saying, yeah, we have 4,000 gods. No, we have 40,000 gods. No, we have 400,000 gods. Everything that moves, anything that gives off energy
is a god. Isn't that a big insult to the real God? What an insult to demean him to that low status of just one of the things that he's created, one of the minor things that he's created becomes your God. And how degrading to you as a human being who were made for a much higher purpose than worshiping creeping and crawling things. Now, we're going to get three times Paul says God gave them up, or God handed them over, or God release the restraints. We're going to get now this analysis of how a society collapses, how a civilization falls apart. We've already got this idolatry starting in the human heart and people leaving the worship and service of the Lord and drifting off into things that substitute for God. If you don't want to have God in your life, if you don't want to worship the real God, serve the real God, honor the real God, then what does he do? He says, okay, go your own way. If you want to go your own way, I'll let you go your own way. What are the consequences of that? Does God send people to hell? Well, not really. If you want to go there, it's your choice. It's the only option you've got if you decide you don't want God to love you and you don't want to have God in your life. That's where you're going to end up by your own series of choices, right? Did God want that for you? No. No, he wanted from the beginning to restore you. But the fall has been a pretty serious damage to who we are. Therefore, God also gave them up in uncleanness, in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. The evil that's in the world comes out of the human heart. Jesus said this, out of the heart are the issues of life. All the evil, ugly things in the world spring up like water from a well, a corrupt spring. When the restraints against evil are lifted, whether they're the moral restraints of a family or a society, when the restraints are lifted, what happens to human behavior? It goes downhill. The first stage, he picks an illustration here. The first thing that goes wrong in a culture when you generally abandon God is widespread heterosexual immorality. That's the first thing he talks about. Sexual revolution. Now, you're not hardly any of you old enough to remember back in the 50s when the whole sexual revolution began to hit our culture, Playboy and Hustler and premarital and extramarital sex became okay, became popular, that's back in the 50s, that's like 50 years ago. Remember that? Some of you remember that? Remember what it was like before that, when divorce was unthinkable, when you were supposed to stay married, whether you were very happily married or not, where it was shocking and terrible to have sex before marriage or to get into adultery. If you ever were an adulterer or an adulteress, everybody in town disliked you and shunned you. You probably couldn't get a job because that was the prevailing social condition, Christians and non-Christians. So that when a society falls apart, you get widespread sexual promiscuity. It starts at the heterosexual level, and then it goes the next step down. God gave them up in uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. That dishonoring their body would be the reminder that your body is the temple of God. It's the place that God lives. It's a holy sanctuary. What do you do with the temple of God? Who exchanged the truth of God for the lie of the garden. The lie of the garden is you can be your own God and do your own thing and that there are no moral absolutes. That's the fundamental lie, same lie that Adam and Eve bought into. People worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. That's the whole idea here of the worship moves down to the level of being worshipping the creation and the all things created instead of God. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. In your notes today, by the way, I looked up all these Greek words. In Greek, and the Greek words are really vivid and clear. And I think that if you take the time when you go home to look at these words in the original Greek, you'll see how rich they are, how easily we lose the intensity of the argument here. God gave them up to, and for this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for that which is against nature. That would be lesbian homosexuality. Here we now have what are called sins against nature, things that would be called unnatural or contrary to the way the universe was created. And it proceeds in there, likewise the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. After heterosexual promiscuity gets to be socially acceptable, and it's okay for junior high kids to sleep together, and it's okay to have an affair outside of your marriage, then the next level down is for homosexuality to be widely accepted in the culture. I don't have to tell you about that and how that's caught on with the television shows and the nature of the culture today. Now, this is a small part of the society. 3 to 5% of the population is gay, but they've certainly got good PR teams and big lobbies in Washington, and it's now made it socially acceptable. And what makes this worse than other sins is it's being contrary to nature, contrary to the way God created us as male and female. It says God wants the two sexes, not three or one, but two, and God wants the differences and the complementary nature of the sexes preserved, and this next level. Now, can you imagine gay marriages? Well, there's no such thing as. And the homosexual agenda isn't to have monogamous gay marriages. It's to destroy the whole institution of marriage. That's what's behind it all. It's because homosexuals are notoriously promiscuous with many partners of all kinds, and it's a very ugly, sordid kind of lifestyle, obviously. Well, the society is getting bankrupt in a hurry. It doesn't stop here. He's picked the whole area of sexual morality as an illustration of the collapse of a civilization that's supposed to be built around families, by the way. Start from the Garden of Eden. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, shut God out of your mind, harden your conscience, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, not appropriate, not respectful, immodest, being filled with all unrighteousness. Once you begin to slip down this slippery slope downhill, it's anything goes. You take all the moral restraints begin to go. All of them. With all manner of sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness. This is where it begins to be good to look up the original Greeks a little bit. This self-covetousness, this selfish desire to have more of something. More of another person, more money, more power, more this. Maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They're whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Just look at that list of things that the human heart's capable of. Things that come out into the open that were dormant in the heart and now they're widespread in the whole culture, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, people in their heart know that what they're doing is wrong, know that there's a judgment, not only practice such things, things that are worthy of death, things that under the law of Moses would require that you be stoned right away, not only do those things, but approve of those. Associate with and endorse and affirm people who are doing the same ugly things. Okay, now, where is the United States in this list? Have we gone to step one? Yeah, long time ago. Have we gone to step two? Yes. How about step three? Yes. Are we pretty well down near the end? What do you get when you get a society that goes down this process? What do you get? Well, you get a disintegration of the family? Yeah. Sulfur coming out of the sky, you certainly do. You certainly get that. What's gone in the fabric of a culture when you begin to get this kind of a widespread lifestyle? Everybody doing whatever they want. It's lawless. Family, how about families? How about the educational system? How about cheating in business and little white lies? And everybody does what they think is right in their own eyes or wrong in their own eyes. And then you're going to get very hostile towards anybody that would dare to live a lifestyle that was opposed to this. You're a bigot. You guys are all bigots in here. Moral bigots. Fundamentalists. Self-righteous fundamentalists. Yeah. And Jesus is the most hated of all because his lifestyle is our standard. That's right. Is everybody that in the world like this? No. No, there are a lot of moral, decent people in the world who live honest, honorable, quiet lives. Are they off the hook? No. Next week we'll see what those people are, why they get indicted. What happens in any culture when there's a widespread departure from God, when God is cheapened, when the content is eroded out of Christian faith, when knowledge of God fades away and you forget about God in your daily life. It started at the beginning with the breakdown in worship, the breakdown in the personal individual devotion to the Lord, thanksgiving, reading the Bible, spending time with other Christians, honoring God, thinking about God, learning about God. That's what goes first. It happened to us then. Does it happen to churches? Yes, it does. You gradually a little water down the message, tone it down. Seminaries today are asked to turn out preachers who won't talk about sin. Our people don't want a pastor to come and talk about sin, they say. So give us a preacher that'll just give us encouragement and help us to cope with life. Life is tough enough. So we don't need to hear all these awful, ugly things in the Bible. And we're decent people anyway, so we don't need to hear about those things. So just give us preachers that will help us along the way so that we can be happy and successful. Is that wrong? Yes, it is. This is one of the strongest passages in the whole Bible, I think. It's pretty hard to avoid the feeling that the human condition is pretty desperate at heart. When the controls are all off, when it's possible to get away with murder, people will get away with murder. Why is it so hard to take a country like Iraq and liberate them from a tyranny, a terrible tyrant, and get the people to behave themselves? Tyranny's on the inside. Just think of the historic heritage in this country. Think of the results of Christianity being so widespread in this country for a couple hundred years. Think of what the legacy we're living on right now, the dividends of previous generations of Christians. All the things we take for granted in our culture that are fading away, where did they come from? Why do we enjoy the freedom and the quality of life and the blessings of God that we do? Because we had people before us who honored God, thanked God, centered themselves upon God. Now, over the course of history, if you think about the big picture over history, what's the course of history going to be like? Well, the course of history is going to go downhill until human evil comes out widely everywhere, so God's case is proved against everybody. How do you turn this around? What do you do about this? Do you just go into a gated community and lock the door and pretend that it isn't out there and make yourself comfortable for yourself? What do we do about this as Christians? This whole thing going on? We do. Individual responsibility here? Yes. Collective responsibility as Christians? Yeah. How do you fix a society here? Do you write letters to your congressman whenever you see something in the news that you don't like very well? Well, that's probably a Band-Aid on cancer a lot of the times, isn't it? If the society is this rotten through and through, then it doesn't do any good to fix one thing. Why do you suppose the homosexual community proposes getting away with their lifestyles? Well, they look at the heterosexual community and say, Gosh, everybody gets divorced. Everybody's sleeping around. You Christians don't have better marriages than anybody else. So why shouldn't we do whatever we want? What about that with schools? We have some wonderful educational institutions that are openly advocating sexual activity of all kinds in junior high and high school. It's just taken for granted that if you're in high school, you're sexually active. If you're not, if you're a virgin, then you're kind of shunned nowadays. That's where we are. And the end of this list, there's some, please look at these words on here at the end, some of these neat Greek words that start. I put notes in there, and I'd love to look these up. You can look them up on Blue Letter Bible, or you can look them up, and we'll soon have them in our lexicon. Page 3. Ungodliness means without God. But it means without reverence to God, without respect for God. Wickedness, not conforming to that which is right. Not conforming to that which is right. That's kind of active. Righteousness has two aspects. You can be righteous, have righteous standing, but righteousness also means a kind of conduct. You have to be righteous in your daily conduct as well as in your beliefs. So righteousness has that lifestyle thing about it. The word not honoring, the word we get the word doxology from the Greek word for glory, which means to praise, to extol, to magnify, to thank God. The word Eucharist combines the word well and the word grace, to give freely to God. That's the also an idea of praise and worship. Foolish, I've given you a couple definitions of foolish. Lust, there's a whole bunch of different words in Greek for lust. One of the words that occurs here is epithymia, which means strong, intensive, overwhelming desire for anything. It can be good or bad, passion. Impurity means not having been purged. Has the word catharsis in it. Not having had a catharsis of your heart. That's strong. When Jesus comes into your heart, you get a catharsis of your heart, get a washing and cleansing. It goes down and renews your heart. Keep your heart with all diligence. Out of the heart are the issues of life. See, when becoming a Christian means being thoroughly new, thoroughly washed, thoroughly reprogrammed, thoroughly purged of all of your old ways of thinking and your old lusts. Pseudos, the lie is a pseudos, the false, the lie of the garden. Consumed, the word consumed with passion lust is the word burned out. Do you know any people who are burned out? Sure, we do. We know people who are burned out on sex and booze and drugs all the time. See them all the time. People who are wasted, that's the idea in here. The word unseemly, we're not a very modest culture anymore. We're not a culture given to politeness and decorum and good manners. Anything goes. You pick up magazine articles and you read an ordinary. I picked up the New Yorker article yesterday and happened to be reading on slang language in Russia. And they were talking about all the filthy, awful, terrible words that are commonly spoken in Russian that are all what we would call lewd, obscene, inappropriate. And here's this big article going through them. Well, that's inappropriate. Those are not things that people do in polite society. Unbecoming. The word for immorality, porneia, from which we get pornography, is a very broad word in Greek. It means any and all forms of sexual immorality. You can't make that specific. It's very broad. The word porneia, which is used for wickedness, is from the Greek to toil, toilsome. Evil is toilsome. Malice has to do with, you know, people that are malicious, that do things that are deliberately harmful and hurtful. Murder, to take the life of another person out of hatred, to slaughter them. Strife, people that are contentious, that are argumentative, that want to start something just to create a fight. That's in here. Deceit, people who are crafty, deceptive, The Greek word is used to mean to debase metals, to take good metals and load them with inferior metals in order to adulterate the quality of it, adulterate the quality of wine. It's the word deceit. To not be straightforward, to not be honest. Malignity, an evil disposition that tends to put the worst construction on things, to believe the worst. Whisperers. Whisperers. The very Greek word sounds like whispering. Backbiting. You know, we don't talk about backbiting, but it means essentially to speak bad things about another person, especially when he or she isn't there. Well, I do that all the time, but I have to stop and catch myself. I don't want people treating me that way, but I expect that I've got to change first. Haters of God. You wouldn't think people hate God, but it's right in here that people become hateful to God. Insolent, violent, despiteful. The person who proudly defies God. I dare God to strike me down today. If there is a God and there isn't, then he wouldn't do what he's doing. So to openly, flagrantly insult God publicly. To tear down his character. A lot of people do that now. Hubris. Yes, the word hubris. We don't hear that. Hubris is a wonderful word. It means to be puffed up with pride, to have an inflated ego is hubris. Boastful. The word boastful is a very interesting Greek word. It means to wander about in the country like a vagabond. It's also used for quacks and medicine show snake oil artists that run around boastful. Inventors of evil. Isn't it interesting that the human imagination gets to the point where you enjoy inventing new kinds of evil? If you're not content to have the existing evil as bad as it is, that you actually want to think up some new ways to be evil. Well, that's a very terrible thing. Disobedient to parents. Now that suggests, once again, we're talking about families and the character of society and what holds a society together are families. And when kids begin to rebel out of control against parents and show no respect for parents, you've got this whole moral collapse. Heartless, without any natural affection. Covenant breaking, that's the word faithless. Covenant breaking. Divorce is covenant breaking, for instance. Not keeping promises, not paying your debts, not honoring the things you've said you would do. Implacable, means unpersuadable, cannot be reasoned with. Unmerciful, without any pity. Putting a low value on human life, having no respect for other people. Without mercy. If you read through this whole list, you begin to think that the human race is absolutely of no value whatsoever. That the human condition is so desperately bad that we might as well give up right now. And that you are useless, worthless, no good. Totally depraved. Totally depraved. I love that because I'm totally depraved. None of you are, but I am. Every time I see myself anew, there's something that suits me. I like being totally depraved because I know that I need God so much. Now, the bottom line in this sort of sobering episode is even though the human condition is tragic, even though we're ruined, we're still made in the image of God and we're still the objects of His love and He still loves us and He longs to restore what we ought to be. In every single one of us. He wants to give us back what we should have been in the beginning and weren't because of the fall. Yes, now here's this difficult beginning to the message of the gospel would be this announcement of what the human condition is all about. Now, if you're talking to your non-Christian friend, you probably don't want to start right here. You want to start with God loves you. God cares about you. God's interested in you. God would like to liberate you, to heal you. You're valuable. You're important. You're unique. You're one of a kind. You're not a clone. You are so important that Jesus died for you. don't part, but it's necessary, is it not? If you don't see the depth of your need, then you're not likely to want the doctor's remedy. About the, that's about the, all the nations raging. The whole nations rage against God. Now then, now that we started today by talking about the wrath of God. Now we get to the end of the chapter. What is the wrath of God? It's letting people go their own way. It's relaxing the restraints on people. Abandoning people to their own hearts.
How come in the Old Testament it is always a very direct relationship between getting to God and then you will be back? But then in the New Testament it's not a direct relationship.
Yet. Remember, we're taking this little digression through chapters 1, 2, and 3. We're getting this little package analysis of the human condition, and then we're going to get back. Paul's going to come back and step by step show us what this personal relationship's all about. So there's a great deal in Romans.
Yeah, a person can still have a lot of material possessions, but his heart is away from
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Today we talked about the open, obvious forms of sin that are everywhere evident. That's not the whole picture. We have the majority of people in the world aren't in this one of these classes of being openly evil, or they might be secretly evil. We've got another class of people that are self-righteous, that are moral and well-behaved, and we've got to indict them. Then we've got a bunch of religious people in the world who've twisted around who God is and haven't got the right God, and they get indicted. And by the time we get to the end of the third chapter, we'll have everybody. I hope everybody. And at that point, we can talk about why this is such really good news, this love of Jesus, this fact that it doesn't matter what your needs are, you can hand them over to Jesus, and you don't deserve it, but you can have His love and His righteousness and His new life free. Without any strings attached. And you need it, and you can't earn it, and you don't deserve it. Okay? So this is the prelude to the good news. Okay, next week we want to launch in chapter 2. Our Father, thank You for this harsh but accurate analysis of the human condition. All day long we see a world around us on all sides that ignores You, rejects You, hates You, denies You. This is a wonderful reminder that we all have no excuse before You, that You've given us plenty of evidence of Your existence. Your kindness and love is obvious to us, and You're kind in letting the rain come on the just and on the unjust. Father, please help us this week to come closer to You, to draw upon You. Please restore in our hearts the right sense of worship and reverence and awe and appreciation for You. You're a good God, a loving God. You analyze our hearts for us so that we will turn to You wholeheartedly and come into harmony with You and become the objects of Your grace and Your mercy and not Your wrath. Please help us to understand this so that we can explain it to outsiders. And please bring the church back into a deep a state of maturity and awareness of and knowledge and true worship. 24/7. Thanks for the Lord Jesus Christ, who identifies with us so totally. He's become one of us. He who was without sin was made sin for us, so that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. Thanks for our time together. In the name of Jesus. Amen.